Good morning again. I'm Jennifer Bukowski. As I mentioned, I'm president of the Jefferson City Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society, and I'm moderating this panel, which has been approved by the Missouri Bar for both ethics and diversity CLE credit. Thank you, Eddie Grime, for going to bat for us on that. Housekeeping items. After this panel, we'll have Panera boxed lunches downstairs, like directly below where registration is on the second floor, in front of the Secretary of State's office. Then we'll come back here for the critical race theory panel promptly at 12:15. A quick program update. We will have brief remarks from Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft at 1:30. And after our keynote speaker, we'll have a reception at the High Rise Bakery, which is on High Street, one block down from the Missouri Supreme Court, so pretty close by. Lieutenant Governor Mike Kehoe and Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft will be at the reception, and during the reception, we'll have a book signing with our keynote speaker, Vivek Ramaswamy. The Federalist Society has purchased a limited number of 49, because I'm keeping this one, copies of the book. For first come, first serve basis, and I've read it and I highly recommend it. It's a terrific book. And now to the topic of today's panel. How should we think of lawyer shaming? At the close of the Trump administration, we saw an effort to deter law firms from rehiring attorneys leaving the Department of Justice and to encourage corporate America to decline to work with firms that had rehired such attorneys. And efforts have since moved on to targeting law firms with clients involved in the fossil fuel industry, including a recent effort which saw hundreds of Harvard and Yale law students sign a pledge not to work for Paul Weiss as long as that firm had ExxonMobil as a client. This has been accompanied by an increase in bar complaints filed against attorneys handling controversial cases. As a matter of legal ethics and industry norms, how should we think of such efforts, and is there a consistent legal principle or principles that should govern? Is viewpoint diversity still an asset to law firms and academia, or is it becoming a potential liability in the current climate? Here to discuss these topics are our esteemed panelists. Stephen Davis is a partner at True North Law, LLC, specializing in trial and appellate property rights litigation in federal courts. Steve also specializes in election litigation, having served as the Missouri Election Day Operations Director for the Mitt Romney presidential campaign, where he oversaw all election law-related issues in the state. Prior to entering private practice, Steve served as an assistant United States attorney in the Eastern District of Missouri. Earlier in his career, Steve was elected as the 62nd Chief Clerk and Administrator for the Missouri House of Representatives. Chuck Hatfield is recognized by Chambers USA as the preeminent government relations litigator in Missouri. He draws on 25 years' experience litigating and negotiating very high-profile cases, primarily involving some sort of government action, to offer his clients a broad and insightful perspective on Missouri's judiciary and broader government relations. He was named Missouri Lawyers Media Lawyer of the Year, one of two, in 2022. He's a partner at Stinson LLP, where he chairs the Financial Services and Class Action Litigation Division, as well as the Government Solutions Practice Group. And Professor Gary Myers is the Earl F. Nelson Professor of Law at the University of Missouri-Columbia, where he served as Dean of the Law School from 2012 to 2016. Myers received his Juris Doctor with honors from Duke University School of Law and graduated summa cum laude with a bachelor's degree in economics from New York University. He has co-authored five books and more than a dozen articles on topics such as intellectual property, antitrust law, and entertainment law. Prior to entering academia, he clerked for an 11th Circuit Court of Appeals judge and practiced complex litigation at a firm which has since merged with Bryan Cave. I'll ask Steve and then Chuck to start us out with some examples and thoughts about this topic, and then Gary will address the ethical rules for us to consider. Steve?
All right. Well, I'm going to stand at one of these microphones because I've always wanted to do that and was never allowed to. It's good to be here back in my old digs. My kids used to crawl around the floor of the chamber when we were at a session, so it's fun to be here. I'm grateful to be asked to be on this panel. it's kind of cathartic for me to have thought about this topic, and grateful to be invited. I handed out a handout. It didn't get to the front. I'm sorry, I didn't make enough copies because I was tardy and too late to get my handout in the materials for today. But if you'd like a copy, please let me know. Most of you probably already have what I handed out because it was part of this a recent issue of the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy that a lot of us get in the mail. It's Eugene Scalia's recent 2019 speech to the Federalist Society, and it's published as an essay in there on lawyer shaming and cancel culture. So I thought that would, I'm gonna draw some of my remarks today from that. So I've been asked to kick us off providing some examples of lawyer shaming in recent times, and then to share my own recent experience. I practice in a very small boutique firm with, it's me and Thor Hearn. Many of you know Thor, but we filed, Thor's been active in election law politics for a long time in Missouri, and in this latest cycle, we filed a lawsuit in Michigan on behalf of the Trump campaign and voters in Michigan. So I'll talk about that. Because this is an ethics panel, I thought I'd start by reciting a couple ethics rules. ABA Model Rule 3.1, I don't think this is very controversial. It's adopted, I assume, in every state. A lawyer shall not bring or defend a proceeding or assert a, or controvert an issue therein unless there is a basis in law or fact for doing so that is not frivolous, which includes a good faith argument for an extension, modification, or reversal of existing law. So we're not supposed to file frivolous actions, right? I've been accused of doing that. I'll talk about it in just a minute. And then a more controversial rule, ABA Model Rule 8.4G, it is professional misconduct for a lawyer to engage in conduct that the lawyer knows or reasonably should know is harassment or discrimination on the basis of race, sex, religion, national origin, ethnicity, disability, age, sexual orientation, gender identity, marital status, or socioeconomic status in conduct relating to the practice of law. All right, so former Labor Secretary Scalia, in his speech to the Federalist Society, said this. He said, one of the great traditions of the profession, the legal profession, is respect for the right to representation of those with whom we disagree, and even to undertake that representation ourselves. John Adams's defense of the British soldiers charged with the Boston Massacre is one of the nation's most important stories about the practice of law. So that's kind of the archetypal example of defending an unpopular client, and we revere that as lawyers today. Mr. Scalia talks about other more recent examples of defending unpopular clients, and I'm going to start with DOMA. Many of you have probably heard of Paul Clement, who was counsel for members of the U.S. House of Representatives, which was Republican controlled at the time. So at the time, Paul Clement worked at a big firm, King and Spalding, in DC. Of course, DOMA, I remembered the passage of DOMA. I think it passed with 380 something votes in the House and 80 something votes in the Senate. It didn't seem particularly controversial at the time. President Bill Clinton signed it into law. But when Paul Clement wrote a brief defending the law, a campaign was organized by the Human Rights Campaign, civil rights group. In a press release, the group equated defense of DOMA with discrimination. And that's why I recited that ABA model rule. They said Paul Clement was engaging, and his firm was engaging in discrimination. They said this: the firm of King & Spalding has brought a shameful stain on its reputation in arguing for discrimination against loving married couples. No amount of taxpayer money they rake in will mitigate this blemish on the King & Spalding name. And as you may remember, the result of that was that Paul Clement left King & Spalding to form his own boutique law firm and of course took his client with him. Mr. Scalia, if you don't know, Mr. Scalia is son of Justice Scalia, also related examples of the DACA case, which was President Trump's cancellation of the Obama administration program under which certain young people who entered the country illegally received forbearance from deportation. So Scalia noted that about 25 large law firms filed amicus briefs in the Supreme Court against DACA, and he noted that zero large law firms filed a brief in support of the administration's position. Then he said, similarly, in the same term, the court decided a case concerning whether Title VII's prohibition of sex discrimination includes discrimination based on sexual orientation. That's the Bostock case. And he noted that about 20 large law firms filed amicus briefs supporting the plaintiffs in a broad reading of Title VII. Not a single law firm filed a brief supporting the defendant. And he noted that, large law firms have started refusing to take positions in these controversial areas, and that void has in part been filled by smaller boutique law firms. He says, corporate executives cannot be expected to know, respect, or defend the values of the legal profession. That is the role of members of the bar. Firms, therefore, must explain to clients that no single representation defines the firm. The firm will allow its lawyers to provide pro bono representation to murderers without approving of murder. Its lawyers will represent companies charged with security violations without approving of defrauding widows and orphans. And its lawyers will represent the Little Sisters of the Poor without, heaven forbid, accepting the teachings of the Catholic Church. So those are a few examples that many of us have heard of. I've been asked to share my example in Michigan with the lawsuit that Thor and I filed. Like Missouri, Michigan requires that, they call them absent voter ballots, we call them absentee ballots. They require that bipartisan teams of election workers open and process and count those ballots. Fair enough. Michigan law also allows for challengers assigned by each political party to observe the process, make sure it's being conducted above board. Starting on election day, absent voter ballots in the city of Detroit were begun to be opened and processed. In Michigan, they don't allow for pre-election day processing of the ballots like we do. Like we do here, many of us in this room have observed that process. I spent the last election day in St. Louis County observing that process of opening and processing absentee ballots. So our lawsuit concerned what happened in the city of Detroit. All of the absent voter ballots in the city of Detroit were processed in what's called the TCF Center. That's the name of Detroit's large convention center. So they set up dozens and dozens of tables of election workers, bipartisan teams, to open and process the ballots. And there were hundreds of challengers in the room, at the beginning at least, to observe the process. Now in Michigan, the parties themselves can actually credential the challengers. It doesn't have to go through the election authority. So there are many more challengers allowed to be present in Michigan than there would be in a state like Missouri. Hundreds of Democrat, Republican, and nonpartisan challengers attended to observe the ballot processing. Over 100 Republican challengers who would be later that day expelled from the TCF Center submitted affidavits alleging that they were denied the opportunity to observe the process, that they were ridiculed by election workers in Detroit, that election workers were placing ballots in the wrong piles. They were running the ballots through the tabulation machines more than once. That when a machine couldn't read a ballot and it had to be duplicated to another ballot, well, that process was taken over in the corner without the bipartisan team, and the ballot was duplicated without letting anyone observe the process. And there was one election challenger who was an attorney who reported that an election worker actually told her, the challenger, that the supervisors were telling her to backdate ballots, backdate the time that the ballots were received, so it would look like they were received prior to election day when they were actually received after the deadline. And she took, and that election worker actually wrote it down on a note and gave it to her because she was afraid to speak to her, so she put it on a note. And that challenger, that Republican lawyer challenger, took a photo of that and submitted an affidavit with the photo, which we included in our lawsuit. Now, all this to say that there were, I think, non-frivolous allegations of irregularities happening in Detroit at least this one absent voter counting processing center that I believe were, again, non-frivolous. But the court would later say that that was hearsay, and you could argue that one affidavit could be hearsay, but you could disagree about that, I think. The Detroit Free Press said, shortly after 1 p.m., officials shut the door to the absentee ballot counting room and turned away all new challengers. And if a challenger had left, they were not allowed to re-enter. They boarded up the windows with pizza boxes, and so it just got worse from there. We filed a lawsuit the afternoon of the next day. The court did not convene a hearing that day, chose to convene a hearing the next morning. When the next morning came, the judge delayed the hearing a couple of hours. We got on the Zoom call, this was COVID, we got on the Zoom call for the hearing and it was just a blank screen for a couple hours. When the judge came on and convened the hearing, then the Secretary of State of Michigan reported that about a few minutes before absentee ballot processing and counting had been concluded, and therefore there was no controversy anymore. It was done, and the judge said the case was moot. We filed an emergency appeal that night. In Michigan, you have to file an appeal package. We thought we should get that filed that night, but there was no transcript from the hearing. There was no transcript available, so we filed everything except the transcript. I was up all night again, drafting a brief to file, motions for emergency consideration, a motion for expedited hearing, the brief. But because we filed no transcript, the next day the court rejected our appeal and said it was an improper filing. To which Mark Elias immediately took to Twitter and ridiculed us. And I think we were even on late night talk shows. I've heard rumors of that, saying that we were so incompetent that we couldn't even file a proper appeal. When we refiled the appeal as soon as the transcript was available. And by the time the court heard the appeal, county had certified the election results, and two judges on the panel said the appeal was moot. And then we got a dissent from one judge said, the issue of mootness is more than the elephant in the room. The issues are not moot because state electors have not been seated, the Electoral College has not been assembled, and Congress has not yet convened to consider whether to exercise its powers under Article 2. Further, plaintiff's prayer for segregation, all we asked for was an injunction that the ballots be segregated at this one counting center. Plaintiff's prayer for segregation of absentee ballots has, on information not yet been ordered by defendant Secretary of State, also the right of plaintiff to election inspectors and to observe video of ballot drop boxes is self-evident under state law, thus entitling plaintiff to at least declaratory relief. But the appeal was dismissed. Review by the Supreme Court was denied. Following the lawsuit, I was interested to see that Congressman Bill Pascrell of New Jersey wrote a letter to the Michigan Bar asking that Thorhern and I be disbarred for filing a frivolous lawsuit. After that, a campaign was quickly organized on Facebook where our law firm, True North Law, was described as racist vote suppressors, and there was a demonstration outside our office. Fortunately for us, the Clayton Police Department called us that morning and let us know about the demonstration so that we could, at least I could get out of town. That's my experience.
Thanks, Steve. Chuck?
Thanks. So when Jen called me with this topic, I don't use the word shame in daily conversation very much, and so I immediately thought of Game of Thrones, right, where Queen Cersei has her head shaved, and she has marched through the streets of King's Landing with someone in front of her chanting, shame, shame, shame. That's what I thought of. Now, remember, Queen Cersei was having sex with her brother, and they had fathered three children, or he had fathered three of her children. So shame sometimes is deserved, right? And I think that's one of the things that we're going to talk about, and Dean Myers is going to talk about how we as lawyers draw the line. This idea of shame in our society is not unique to our profession or to any particular party. I was telling Stephen, I think this is very timely. You know, I was watching Fox News yesterday, as I always do on Sunday morning, and Newt Gingrich was on. And Speaker Gingrich was talking about the January 6th commission, the congressional commission that is investigating what happened on January 6th, and he compared it to a lynch mob. And then he went on to say that Attorney General Merrick Garland had thrown himself in with this lynch mob. And then he went on to say, and you can follow this on social media, that when the Republicans retake Congress, which he predicts they will do, that the wolves will become the sheep, and those who have joined in this effort may face criminal charges. So, to me, this idea of shaming is about sort of where do we draw the line. Sometimes we're worthy of shame. We should perhaps be more ashamed of things that we do as humans and even as lawyers. But where are you going to draw the line? Are we going to start locking people up for having opinions? You know, we talked about content moderation a minute ago. As lawyers, we're used to content moderation. We're not allowed to say anything we want in a court of law. And if you don't believe me, try it in a federal court sometime. Just say whatever you want and see how the judge reacts if you say something that's not supported by the record or that is otherwise offensive to the court. We are a profession that believes in content moderation. We believe in limiting ourselves in the things that we say and in the way that we say them. And we have to grapple a little bit with where are we going to draw the line on that. And I was asked to talk about some examples that aren't nearly as personal as what Stephen has, although I would say that my law firm was also protested during the Michael Brown protests because we had represented St. Louis County at times, and we had protesters as well. So I have some experience with that, but I want to talk about maybe as a transition to Dean Myers' more precise and academic, believe it or not, discussion. You know, there are variations to all of this, and again, I've got a note here that I forgot to say. This is not unique to our profession, right? If you think that we're the only ones who experience economic displeasure, right? Don't hire this person, don't work with that person because of what we did. Ask Colin Kaepernick whether this is an issue that our society is grappling with. But I'm also sort of, when I mention Colin Kaepernick, I guess I do have to say, as perhaps in the role of provocateur, I don't really feel that sorry for Kaepernick. I don't really feel that sorry for a millionaire football player who doesn't get to play football. And I have a little trouble feeling sorry for lawyers sometimes because we have a lot of privilege Paul Clement is going to be just fine out of all this. And I hope we'll talk about that. I know Jen's got some things on the agenda where we can talk about that. As we move to Dean Myers, so where do we draw the line, right? Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell have had bar complaints filed, and Mr. Giuliani has been suspended for things that they said to a court of law in signed pleadings that a court determined were unsupported or were incorrect. Dean Myers is going to tell you what rule that is. Most of you probably know. John Eastman had a bar complaint filed in California because of a memo that he wrote to the President of the United States. So this was advice to a client on how to challenge the current state of the law. Not something he said in court, but advice that he gave to a client. Now, to be clear on Eastman, he was also, the part of the complaint is also for things that he said from the stage at the January 6th rally, which raises another issue, right? So we have things we say to the court, things we say to clients, things we say publicly. And then one of the examples that our discussion said to talk about, we decided we should talk about, Senator Holly. There's been a request from some Missouri lawyers that the Missouri Disciplinary Council office investigate Senator Holly for actions that he took on the floor of the United States Senate in challenging electoral results. So these are official actions done in his official capacity, which to me, I didn't vote for Senator Holly, probably not gonna. To me, that's nuts that you would have a bar complaint filed for official actions that you take on the floor. But these are the various degrees that we're seeing with lawyers of the types of things that one can be criticized for. And Dean Myers is going to give us some structural context in which to think about these issues.
Well, good morning, everyone. And first of all, thank you, Jen, for organizing this panel, and Steve and Chuck for your comments. No pressure. I'll see if I can put some specifics into this. But I actually want to go back to something Steve mentioned, which is, I think, a little bit of history is always helpful. And so before we get into the rules, I want to talk about two historical examples. He mentioned one, and that was John Adams and his defense of the British captain and troops who fired upon the protesters in what became known as the Boston Massacre. And if you look at that, I think to me it illustrates the idea, the fundamental principle, which Jen asked about, which is that everyone is entitled to legal representation, to a lawyer, and to due process. And those soldiers were tried. Now, let me give you a little fact that you might not know. Not all of them were acquitted. The captain and most of the soldiers were, but two soldiers were found guilty of the lesser offense of manslaughter. Again, this is the process, the way it's supposed to work. One more bit of history. Going back a little further in colonial times, the Peter Zenger trial, which you may recall is about freedom of speech and freedom of the press. Zenger ran a newspaper. He was critical of the royal governor. And the royal governor responded by saying that he was engaged in sedition and libel, and he was prosecuted for that. A jury of his peers found him not guilty. Now, here's a little less known fact about that. His first lawyer, James Alexander, was found in contempt by the judge for questioning the whole process and was later disbarred for his role in that. So I think the takeaway there is be careful if you have a king, because this is what you might end up with. And so the principle that I take from these cases is we have a rich and long history that lawyers should be, they aren't always, but they should be able to represent their clients vigorously, to be zealous advocates, the duty that that we all know about. And at the same time, yes, lawyers are officers of the court. And I fully agree with that. And as I listen to some of the examples and the idea of where do we draw some of these lines, I want to talk about a couple of those. And I'll start with this. We've heard discussion of the idea of lawyers can't bring a frivolous claim Totally agree with that, obviously. And that the claim has to be warranted by existing law or a good faith argument for changing the law, and that any factual allegation, and I want to quote this rule for just a minute since we have this ethics credit, bear with me, just a short quote. Factual contentions have evidentiary support, or if specifically so identified, will likely have evidentiary support after a reasonable opportunity for further investigation and discovery. And to me, it's that last part, that we need to have a full investigation and discovery, and that we should be troubled if lawyers are put in a position where there are bar complaints against them for filing a claim where there may well be a factual basis after investigation and discovery. That to me is a troubling precedent. You know, I read the bar journals of Missouri and Georgia, my former state, on a regular basis, and I almost never see any finding of a bar complaint saying that a lawyer filed a suit and turned out maybe the facts weren't all there. That's not usually what the bar complaints are about, and I think it sets a very disturbing precedent if that's what bar complaints now are going to be about. Now, is there a line that should be drawn? Yes, but I don't think that line is when you have a pressured situation such as the aftermath of an election where there's a limited amount of time to certify the results, there's a limited amount of time for investigation of the information that is in the complaint, a limited amount of time to interview witnesses, a limited amount of time to get documents or a transcript. And that in that circumstance, which in a way is kind of almost like a wartime situation, it's a crisis situation, for that not to be taken into account would be a deeply troubling precedent. I don't think anyone who's a lawyer and who cares about our justice system would want to see that happen. Now, are there situations where there can be violations? And I'm going to give you one, and that is, to quote this rule again, a lawyer shall not knowingly make a false statement of fact or law to a tribunal or fail to correct a false statement of material fact or law previously made to the tribunal by a lawyer. Now, what's an example of what I think of as a shaming that we should have? Does everyone remember Kevin Kleinsmith? Put your hand if you remember him. Couple hands up. Not too many folks remember him. He was an FBI attorney. He was the attorney who filed the documents for the FISA court in 2016 in the so-called Russia collusion investigation. And Mr. Kleinsmith filed documents that included emails, internal FBI emails, deliberately leaving out potentially exonerating information about subject number one, individual number one, who turned out to be Carter Page. And the point of that was that the information suggested that Page had been involved on behalf of intelligence agencies in the US, which would contradict somewhat the claim that he was involved with Russian agents. Now, why do I bring up Kleinsmith? Well, he had to plead guilty to making false statements on three occasions to the FISA court. He was sentenced to probation, be that as it may. The point is, that's an example of the kind of thing that warrants shaming, a true false representation to a court. Now, we have obviously some bar complaints against Sidney Powell and against Rudy Giuliani, and there have been preliminary findings against them. But, you know, the question there is, was there a knowing statement of falsity made? Was it reckless disregard? It's actually the standard we heard mentioned earlier of New York Times versus Sullivan, knowledge of falsity or reckless disregard. That's a very high threshold to establish. And so that, I think, is a fair question. It's a fair question. Now, there are various other rules that are sometimes, I think, ambiguous. For example, engaging in conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice. Can you be found in violation of that rule based on your filings, your representations of clients? I think, again, that's a troubling thing. Here's my bottom line point. We want people to be able to secure counsel of their choosing and to have due process, even if they're people who engaged in conduct that we dislike. A terrorist gets to have representation. Harvey Weinstein should get to have representation. That's an example that we haven't talked about, but one of his lawyers was an administrator at Harvard Law School. He joined the legal team of Weinstein, whose conduct has, I think, been found and proven to be despicable. But the question is, does he get a lawyer? And should an administrator at Harvard lose his position for being a part of that legal team? And that, to me, is an illustration of the troubling precedent. There are many others, and I think we have a lot of questions, so I'm gonna stop here and let us have a discussion. So, thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Okay, for the panel, let's move on to viewpoint diversity. What is the state of viewpoint diversity in the practice of law, or for Gary, in academia? And what should it be? Is viewpoint diversity a desirable strength to seek, or is it becoming a potential liability in our current climate? I'll have Chuck and then Gary and then Steve take up that question.
So viewpoint diversity. When Jen said we're going to talk about this, she said, well, Chuck, maybe you can talk about, you know, the larger law firms like mine. And there is a fairly narrow band of viewpoint within a large law firm. We don't have a lot of Marxists, for example, because generally, if you've ever studied Marxism in college, the law is a tool of the capitalists and the ruling class, and therefore not a lot of folks find their way into our profession. We also don't have a lot of socialists in big law, right? Generally, the folks that make it want to make money, and they enjoy making money, and they enjoy being paid by their clients. I find that where I practice, big law, it also suffers from a lack of diverse viewpoints for a couple of other reasons. We are, as a profession, and as I look around the room, I think I can validate this, we are a white male profession to a larger extent, particularly on gender side, to a larger extent than society. Tend to be a lot of men, but then on the other hand, in big law firms like mine, tend to be located generally in more urban areas and very well educated. And so we have a fairly narrow band of experiences, I think, in the legal world. I think that's good and bad, right? We want common language, we want common understandings of the way that the law is supposed to work, but we also need to be able to look at things in different ways. You know, there are some studies out there, some of you may be familiar with, that say that if you're going to try a case, that a team made up of a man and a woman is much more likely to predict the outcome of the case and the settlement range than a team of two men or two women. And I think the analogy applies otherwise. The more different viewpoints you can get together, whether that's somebody who approaches things from, you know, we're talking about political diversity, I know. So whether you're talking about someone who approaches things from a very conservative political leaning, very liberal political leaning, I think it's very helpful to analyzing what we do and to thinking about things in different and unique ways. You know, as a big law firm lawyer, we don't really try cases to juries much anymore. It's a little bit of a thing of the past. But when I have tried cases, particularly in Jackson County, which I have the most recent experience, I'm struck by the difference between the lawyers and our experiences and what we're going through when we go home and the education that we have and the people sitting in that jury box. It is a different group of people there than the people that I generally interact with on a daily basis. And so I think diversity of viewpoint, diversity of experience is important to us. If we're going to represent our clients well, we have to be able to think about things in different ways so that we can present them to different audiences, be those judges or jurors.
So I work in a law school, part of a large university, and of course colleges and universities are supposed to be the places where there's debate, where people can question and disagree, civilly discuss issues, and that is of course the theory of what happens at colleges and universities. Is that really what happens at colleges and universities today? I think increasingly that's a challenging question. You can certainly, and I mean this literally, find hundreds of examples where academic freedom of students, of faculty, of staff are threatened by actions of administrators, by groups of students, and by others who want to silence dissenting or differing voices. So I think that's a very real problem in academia. On the other hand, is the situation completely bleak? I don't think it is. So I'd start with my own school, University of Missouri. We've adopted a version of the Chicago Principles, which started at the University of Chicago, kind of like the Federal Society chapter. And the idea behind those principles is that you have honest and fair debate, that you have the freedom to disagree and engage in discussion of issues of public concern without having any punishment. So that's a nice policy, and at least the document is there. I also think you have the luxury that I have of teaching at a state university where any action that might be taken against you would be state action, and so you have constitutional protections there for free speech. So the situation is not completely bleak. Now, having said that, I think there's increasingly a movement towards less consideration of the importance of free speech and expression, and more of a consideration for other countervailing, counterbalancing factors. And that's something I think we have to be very aware of and concerned about. And I literally know of personal examples of people who've been given various sanctions in their class because of things they've said in their classroom that are completely appropriate and relevant to the topics, or things they've asked on an exam that are completely relevant to the subject matter of the course. And many professors today, I think, are very reluctant about what they're going to say in a classroom because of that threat. And so what I would close on this point would be, I started teaching in law school in 1989, and I became a tenured full professor around 1996. So I've been around a long time with the protections that tenure at a state university gives you. And I think today is the point at which I feel less free to speak than I ever have earlier in my career. So there are some changes. I think you have to be very aware of them and very attuned to them. And if you have kids or grandkids going to colleges and universities, you want to ask them about what the status of things would be, because I think there is cause for concern. Thank you.
I can't speak so much about diversity of law in big law firms, although I did come from a large DC law firm a couple years ago. And I can say that it's nice to be at a small firm. We have flexibility to do what we choose to do and represent who we choose to represent, and of course less conflicts of interest naturally. I can say that the firm I was a part of, Arent Fox, they had a diversity of views, and I enjoyed it very much. They employed Bob Bennett from Utah and Byron Dorgan, and Jim Talent was worked there for a time. So it was enjoyable. There was a good balance at the firm, but I think that I get the impression that big law is not that's diminishing at big law firms. And again, that, as Eugene Scalia said, that void is being filled by the smaller boutique firms like ours. And I don't know that that's particularly a good thing.
I'll stand to follow you guys. For the panel, are you concerned that lawyer shaming or an uptick in lawyer shaming will have any adverse effects such as damaging the public's view of the bar and the judiciary, or leaving clients without representation, or even making talented individuals reluctant to join future presidential administrations. So are you concerned about any of those things? And do you believe that lawyers should speak out against lawyer shaming, or should we condone it? I'll start with Gary and then go Steve, Chuck.
Well, given what I've said earlier, I'm guessing you probably are not going to be surprised that I think that we do need to fight against lawyer shaming. Again, I agree that there are lines to be drawn, and there are ethics rules that govern lawyers. But as long as the lawyers are staying on the right side of those ethics rules, I think we need to protect and support the right of attorneys to represent clients, regardless of whether they're popular or unpopular. So that's my thought there.
So yes, I am concerned, in spite of my comment that, you know, we'll all be all right, but maybe for different reasons. I mean, I think we have to be cognizant that we need to regulate ourselves. You know, if we don't regulate our own profession, somebody's going to want to regulate us. That's why the government wants to regulate Facebook. So I'll just go back to something Professor Myers said about, you know, your duties of candor and your duties of, and the fact that you can make statements that are not fully supported by your investigation thus far. You know, the key to all that, in my view, is a lawyer's duty of candor to the tribunal and general candor even to opposing parties. If you're going to come into court and say, I don't have any evidence for this, but I think it's going to be true, I think the rules contemplate that you tell the court that. Right now, I don't know, but I have a reasonable basis for what I'm pleading. I have a reasonable suspicion. I have probable cause. All those words that we throw around that other people don't understand, that are code among lawyers for, there is a process in place for us to prove what we say, and we have to start with something. So we can't come into court and say, my client's innocent because aliens came down and did it. It is not a reasonable assertion. Why? I don't know. It's not a reasonable assertion because we all agree that you need more than that. How much more? I don't know. But you've got to be candid with the court. And you know, I have filed pleadings that turn out to be wrong. Of course I have. Witnesses tell you something, and then you get in a deposition, they say the exact opposite thing under oath. And then when you say, well, wait a minute, we pled that, they say, I don't know what you're talking about, right? It's not your fault, but you also have a duty to fix that. You know, you have a duty to fix that and to say to the court, what we said was not true. You have a duty to say to the court, and I've done this, you know what? I read that case again in my pleading, and I'm sorry. It's not what I thought it was. It says something slightly different. We as a profession have to regulate ourselves. We can't just go out there and disregard these rules that Professor Myers talked about. And I think we need to recommit ourselves a little bit, because we have to convince the public that we have that level of integrity, that we're not just gonna come in and make things up, and that when a lawyer says something, it means something. So I am concerned about it, in part because I think we need to do a better job ourselves of holding ourselves accountable.
Yes, I am concerned about this. I think the profession does a fairly decent job of policing ourselves, and I think when you had lawsuits filed by the campaign in Michigan where the process worked out. You had a motion for sanctions filed by the city of Detroit and state of Michigan against counsel in another case, and the judge made a ruling on that. So I don't think that this, I think that the courts can take care of this themselves. I've been in trial and had a witness completely come apart on the stand, and you know, I try to fix the situation on redirect, but that happens. We're lawyers, and in Michigan, in the court, so in the lawsuit that I filed, there was only one court in the state of Michigan that you can file the lawsuit against a state official, and that's the Michigan Court of Claims, and it requires a verified complaint. So our plaintiffs signed an affidavit verifying the information. And we also filed 100 affidavits from Republican election challengers. So I am concerned. I don't think the media does a good job of explaining the context going on behind the scenes. I think they like to just get a splash and create controversy, and the result of that is lawyer shaming and demonstration and even riots. So I am very concerned about it. I have to add one thing that I didn't mention before that I am indebted to Eddie for sending to me. It was the Lynn Wood litigation in Delaware, where Lynn Wood was an attorney for the Trump campaign, and I don't know him or much about him, but after, and Professor Myers brought up Carter Page. Well, Carter Page was a subject of surveillance and those FISA warrants, and then after that came to light, he started suing various media outlets for defamation. And so he filed another lawsuit in Delaware State Court, and Lynn Wood sought to join his defense team and filed a pro hoc motion in the Delaware trial court. And the trial court just I think, acted irresponsibly and denied his pro hoc motion without a hearing on that motion because of Lynn Wood's purported background in the Trump lawsuits. And the trial said, the trial court looked at his Twitter feeds and said, hey, you're responsible for a lot of what happened on January 6th. And the court found that Wood's conduct in the Georgia and Wisconsin litigation, albeit not in the court's jurisdiction, exhibited a toxic stew of mendacity, prevarication, and surprising incompetence. I had to look up mendacity, but I mean, the court just went out on a limb saying, we're gonna deny your pro hoc motion, even after he had withdrawn it, and then that went up on appeal to the Delaware Supreme Court. The Delaware Supreme Court and bank unanimously overruled the trial court's action, saying that it was not appropriate for the trial court to bring in Lynn Wood's reputation, whatever that is, without affording him a hearing or allowing him to withdraw his pro hoc motion. So I'm very concerned about it.
We'll move now to audience questions. If anyone has a question for the panelists, come on up to one of those mics on the aisle that are live so everyone can hear you. On the aisle? No, the aisle.
Steve caught my attention when you said no large law firms are representing some of these more controversial matters. I saw after when Trump retained some of the counsel, the Lincoln Project and other companies, they were going out, somebody shows up at your office, it is what it is. They were finding their client base, going out, telling all those clients they could no longer use that law firm, or the Lincoln Project was saying, is there any basis for any type of, have you thought through tortious interference or defamation claim? If I've got a client base, I've got another client, the Lincoln Project or somebody else begins contacting my other clients and begins interfering with that relationship. Have you thought through that or had that?
And I meant to bring up as a further example, the Lincoln Project, and they went after Jones Day and their client base. I'm going to refrain from. I have not thought through. I think there is something for tortious interference. I think there is a claim there, but I have not thought through that. I think it's. I think that kind of behavior is pretty inappropriate.
Other questions, Lucinda?
Quick question. I know we're standing between lunch. Anybody can answer, but I think, Chuck, I'd be particularly interested in your answer, which is 3 days ago, our mayor of Kansas City tweeted that the state's AG should be sanctioned by the bar for harassing schools with his latest lawsuits. And I'm curious, in the context where you don't have a particular client per se, but you represent the state, how does your analysis change, if at all, and whether or not that's sanctionable, and whether or not it's just politician-on-politician violence?
Well, my analysis does change a little bit. As I said before, I'm just saying, the complaint against Senator Hawley for actions on the floor is ridiculous. I mean, there is absolutely no basis for that. Now, I have other complaints with Senator Hawley, since I got an applause back there. But none of which, in my view, rise to the level of bar complaint. By the way, I'm sorry, I'm on a digression here, but in the category of, you know, we all do this, remember that Senator Hawley also filed his own complaint against Auditor Galloway with her licensing board, and alleged that her official actions in performing an audit violated the ethical rules. That case is currently pending in two venues, one here in Cole County, one at the Administrative Hearing Commission. But I do think it's different, and I think I'm going to answer your question in a slightly different way. Mayor Lucas is a member of the bar, and I think as members of the bar, we need to stop doing that kind of thing. You know, I have a rule in my office with my associates. I never use the word frivolous. I don't like the word. I think as lawyers, for us to use the word frivolous, I think we should only use it in the most extreme of circumstances, which in my career, frankly, maybe twice I've thought that I could use the word frivolous. Let me ask you all, stop doing it. Stop saying that people's lawsuits are frivolous. In the media, if you got to do it in a court filing, you know what the rules are on that, and you can end up paying their attorney's fees if you use the word wrong in court. But we should stop it. And I think Mayor Lucas should stop that. But, you know, if you're an elected official and you're engaged in a political debate, you have certain sort of privileges and immunities. I mean, I use that very loosely. And I certainly, as some of you know, I have criticized the Attorney General's same lawsuits on Twitter. I don't think they're frivolous. I don't think they're improper. I don't think they're the subject of a bar complaint. I disagree with them, and that's fine, right? That's what we should be doing. I have to tell you that my advice, which I think I gave on Twitter the other day, is that those school districts should say, excellent. We're glad the Attorney General has raised this issue. We think that as local school boards, we have absolute authority to control our schools and the health and safety in our schools, and we look forward to seeing them in court, because that's where we ought to decide these things. And I think that's all completely appropriate, and as lawyers, we have to do a better job of saying so and not tearing each other down with words like that. Let's disagree on the law, but let's not do that.
Don't be frivolous with the word frivolous, y'all. All right. Well, I think about right.